That's my favorite organist, Jimmy Smith, with his famous Hammond B3, opening the Sermon, the title track of his acclaimed 1958 album. Lee Morgan on trumpet, Lou Donaldson on alto sax, Tina Brooks on tenor, Kenny Burrell on guitar, and Art Blakey on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And a couple of things I thought I would kind of bring to your attention today. He had brazenly interfered in U.S. domestic affairs when he hijacked a joint session of Congress on March the 3rd to urge legislators to scuttle U.S. and international negotiations on Iran, on its nuclear program. He and several of his senior advisors have spoken and continue to speak rather disparagingly of President Barack Obama and his administration. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is back in Washington today, and he's looking for a $40 billion, that's with a B, $40 billion handout in military aid. And if history has anything to do with things, it is likely that Congress will give it to him. And the same President Obama that he has disparaged and he treats so scornfully also will go along with the program. And so we'll pause and talk about this a little bit. Talk about U.S. foreign aid to Israel, particularly military aid. As you know, Netanyahu has done much to embarrass not only himself and his state, but all good people have good conscience all over the world with his actions and his activities. Which are trenchantly Zionist, as you know, the idea that it should be okay with the world that Palestinians should be regarded as bacteria to be contained and preferably just simply removed and annihilated, so that Palestine, which used to be a land for everybody, people historically, of all ethnic groups and cultures, have occupied Palestine for a long time. They've lived there and had no problem prior to World War II, particularly World War II, when the United States really decided to beef up its support for this new land in 1948 called Israel, which no longer is called Palestine. The original people, just like in the United States and just like in Africa, just like in most other countries that had been visited by marauders of one kind or another, the program is very straightforward. Get rid of them or get them under heavy, heavy control, or both, and simply take the land and everything on it, in it, around it, over it, under it, and claim it. In fact, I was sharing with someone today, I was an early movie buff. My father owned a movie theater, and I got into this business of the movies quite early. And I remember one of the blockbuster movies, Exodus, starring Paul Newman, Sal Mineo, and a host of other stars of the time, essentially glorifying the establishment by guerrilla tactics, I might add, some people would call it terrorism, of this state called Israel. But it was set to such beautiful music. The theme song was sung so smoothly by Andy Williams. And what does this theme song say? The first lines, "This land is mine. God gave this land to me." And it was just so romanticized. And I remembered watching the movie and rooting for them. Yes, kill off those awful Arabs. They're in the way. And we identified with this noble objective to survive, because the whole world is against us. And look what we have to do, all these things that we have to do, all these things we must suffer, because the world hates us because we are Jews, and we have to survive in this land which God gave us. And even though we haven't been here for tens of thousands of years, we will now gather ourselves from wherever we are, and we will now claim this land. Now, who is going to argue with God? You just declare, God gave you the land, and therefore it's yours to claim by any means necessary. This essentially is the Zionist principle. The idea that there is a rationale, there is cause, godly cause, to systematically kill off and remove people from the land that they have been living in and on and from for tens of thousands of years. But interestingly, as we've been discussing about empires, the empires at the time, colonial and imperial empires, Britain, France, and the United States, had a vested interest in coming to the aid of this burgeoning Zionist nation informed by Zionist principle, because Jews were being slaughtered. Your Eastern European Jews, we have to be very careful about this. This is very, very important. Eastern Jews throughout Europe were being slaughtered in the European countries they lived, and their plight was ignored in the same way that we see this happening with other countries all over the world. When it's convenient for these empires to ignore it, they simply ignore it. So they ignored it, and in fact were aiding and abetting, as Britain did, boldly, as France did, as even the United States did, aided and abetted Hitler's regime. And in the same way that Hitler basically came to the fore. He began to galvanize support, political support, and consequently political control, was by demonizing not just Jews, because it's very seldom conjoined here, but the Roma people, who are called disparagingly, we know the term gypsies, but they were a cultural group, a very populous group, a nomadic group of people. They were not, quote, white, unquote. And they were used to create within Germany at the time this feeling of otherness. They're not of the superior race. And this whole concept of superior race, supremacy, white supremacy, which Germany had the opportunity to observe, was working to such good effect in the United States, which was what slavery and the slave culture, the slavocracy, was all about. It gave birth to this notion that there must be some genetic rationale for the heinous and inhumane way of life in the United States, but also quite profitable. So in the same parallel of demonizing and subjugating people of color and the First Nations people here in the United States, the parallel program began in Germany. And first, the first people wiped out by the millions were the Roma. And it worked really well. It was a very, very good thing. And even though we heard in our discussions last week that none other than Benjamin Netanyahu says, well, actually, Hitler didn't really mean to exterminate the Jews. He meant mostly to expel them from Germany. But it was an evil, nasty, horrible religious leader, of course, Palestinian, in what is now today called Israel. At that time, it was called Jerusalem, because it was part of Palestine. He was the one who inspired Hitler to come up with this grand idea of mass genocidal cleansing of the inferior Jews, and therefore create a superior Aryan race in Germany. But make no mistake, he was not original. This was not an original idea with Adolf Hitler. It was working quite efficiently by that time in the United States and elsewhere in the world, where the colonial powers had seen it as being in their interests to do so. Because in these lands where they ventured purely for plunder and economic reasons and to expand their empires, you had to have a rationale. Very often, for example, the Catholic Church provided it. The Catholic Church provided the rationale for slaughter all throughout the world. Dominus vobiscum, get on your boats and go elsewhere and just kill off the people. Take the good, just bring back the goodies, bring back the emeralds and the pearls and the diamonds and whatever else. And God bless you, my son. Go forth and slaughter in the name of the Lord. So it provided the philosophical rationale for extraordinary, heinous acts. So that brings us to Netanyahu today. With the other empires now embarrassed by their inaction while people were being slaughtered to the tune, they say, of 6 million. While people were being slaughtered in Europe, and while their ethnicity and culture formed the basis and the rationale for the program, or became the program to exterminate them, the empires many times just turned a blind eye. But because they were so embarrassed, they had to do something, and they responded by saying, in nominal ways at first, and then the United States got a little bit more active and said, okay, what we need to do, because we are the land of the free and the home of the brave, we are just an honorable people, and we must do whatever we can to support those people who are vilified and the targets of genocide. And so we will open the doors and we will help this burgeoning nation to be formed, and after being formed, we will support it because naturally it has to secure itself. And that whole term of security has been very, very important to the new philosophy that forever, given how this new land called Israel was formed, the Zionist principles that informed it and that gave the rationale, provided the rationale for its creation, they knew that it was such an extraordinary idea that God gave you this land. You knew that there was going to be opposition and you knew there was going to be resistance. So from the very beginning, Israel anticipated that it will continue to have as a main objective not only the conquest of the land, but securing its conquest. And so the empires that supported this had to come up with a way of maintaining this notion of eternal security for this new found country that expected itself to be under eternal attack by the people who just didn't like the idea of being conquered and then subjected, it seems, forever and ever to an inferior way of life targeted essentially for annihilation. One way or the other, you are not going to be equal in this land, even if you manage to survive and stay here. We have all kinds of ways of controlling your life and the lives of others for several generations. Today, as you know, in Palestine, they call the Palestine, they call where the Palestinians live, the world's largest open-air prison. It is walled in. Movement within that walled-in territory severely restricted. It makes apartheid South Africa look tame by comparison. You are constantly under threat of annihilation, military attack. You do not enjoy the resources of your land, your historic land. Palestinians dare not even assume that they can go fishing in the waters just off their coast so that they can eat. Every aspect of life rigidly controlled and not to yield a pleasant life experience. Inferior education or no education, unemployment very, very high. You don't really have a home. You are constantly targeted by the Israeli military. This is what daily life is for Palestinians who are the descendants of the first peoples of that region. So Benjamin Netanyahu comes to town and he's expecting to leave with $40 billion, about $4 billion for the next 10 years with free money. And that money is going to shore up Israel's defenses against attacks. That's the rationale. And while this is going to be a serious consideration in Congress, and it's pretty much anticipated, he will get every penny that he is asking for. But he's not asking, really. He's demanding it. the engine, the support engine for this is hard at work. He was able to demonstrate in March when he came to address a joint session of Congress. He was able to demonstrate quite effectively that he could come in your house and tell you what to do, uninvited by the President of the United States. He could come in your House of Congress and tell you, your job is to oppose that man and to oppose anything he wants to do. That's your job, because Israel supersedes, and the interests of Israel supersede your interests as Americans. And I am here as a head of state of a whole other country. I could commandeer your democratic process and tell you what you ought to do, give you orders. You legislators who are hired to do your job of representation by the so-called people, I could come here and tell you what to do. And it's backed up by groups like the American Israel Political Action Committee. Millions of dollars that go into persuading members of Congress that the only right thing to do is to make sure Israel has what it needs. Never mind the needs of Americans. That's second. The top priority is Israel, and it is not even a humanitarian priority. It is about having military might to squash any and all people we see as our enemies. Well, so what is the nature of this military aid? I thought I would share with you a summary prepared by the Congressional Research Service. And what the Congressional Research Service does is that it prepares little papers, if you will, background papers to give legislators an idea, give them proper context and history for measures they may be considering or having to vote on in Congress. Like, for example, what Netanyahu is here for, which is foreign aid. So, Jeremy Sharp, a specialist in Middle Eastern affairs, working with the Congressional Research Service, prepared this paper on June the 10th, 2015. It is titled U.S. Foreign Aid to Israel. I urge you to go and take a look at it. And here's what it says. I'll just read you from the summary to give you an idea of the investment that the United States has been making in Israel, and then we will follow up with some questions around that. So here's the summary. This report provides an overview of U.S. foreign assistance to Israel. It includes a review of past aid programs, data on annual assistance, and an analysis of current issues. For general information on Israel, see CRS Report RL33476, Israel Background and U.S. Relations by Jim Zanotti. Israel, says this report, is the largest cumulative recipient of U.S. foreign assistance since World War II. To date, the United States has provided Israel $124.3 billion in bilateral assistance. Almost all U.S. bilateral aid to Israel is in the form of military assistance, although in the past, Israel also received significant economic assistance. Strong congressional support for Israel has resulted in Israel receiving benefits not available to any other countries. For example, Israel can use some U.S. military assistance both for research and development in the United States and for military purchases from Israeli manufacturers. In addition, U.S. assistance earmarked for Israel is generally delivered in the first 30 days of the fiscal year, while most other recipients normally receive aid in installments. And Israel, as is also the case with Egypt, is permitted to use cash flow financing for its U.S. arms purchases. In addition to receiving U.S. State Department-administered foreign assistance, Israel also receives funds from annual defense appropriations bills for rocket and missile defense programs. Israel pursues some of those programs jointly with the United States. In 2007, the Bush administration and the Israeli government agreed to a 10-year, $30 billion military aid package for the period from fiscal year 2009 to fiscal year 2018. During his March 2013 visit to Israel, President Obama pledged that the United States will continue to provide Israel with multi-year commitments of military aid subject to the approval of Congress. For fiscal year 2016, the following legislation addresses U.S. foreign assistance to Israel. A draft House Fiscal Year 2016 Department of State Foreign Operations and Related Programs Bill would provide Israel $3.1 billion in FMF, that's again the foreign aid, foreign military funds, as requested. H.R. 1735, the House version of the National Defense Authorization Bill for fiscal year 2016, authorizes up to $371.2 million for various U.S.-Israeli joint missile defense systems, including $41.4 million for Iron Dome, $249.8 million for David's Sling, $34.5 million for Arrow 3, and $45.5 million for Arrow 2. These are all military development programs. Senate 1376, the Senate version of the National Defense Authorization Bill for fiscal year 2016, authorizes up to $372.4 million for various U.S.-Israeli joint missile defense systems. A draft House Fiscal Year 2016 Defense Appropriations Bill will provide $487.595 million for U.S.-Israeli joint missile defense programs, of which $55 million is for Iron Dome, $286.526 million is for David's Sling, $89.550 million is for Arrow 3, and $56.519 million is for Arrow 2. Now, that's the overview of what's currently in play. And that is why Mr. Netanyahu is in town hoping to collect $40 billion in free money. They don't have to pay this. And Israel has not really been required to pay any money back since World War II, having received so far, as the report says, $124.3 billion. Okay. Now, you square that against the evident needs that occur in this country. You square this is a gift to a country that has been terrorizing its first peoples, its first nations, with U.S. taxpayer dollars. And yet you hear things like, well, we have to cut the food stamp program here in the United States. The vast majority of people receiving food subsidies happen to be the elderly and children. But Congress would think not even twice about having to cut $40 billion out of that program. You think about the programs for veterans who had put their lives on the line and who had lost their lives, so that the families should be able to exist in the loss, in the aftermath of the loss of their loved ones. The country says, well, we don't have money. For the elderly, you know, there is a problem. The budget can't just continue to support Social Security for the elderly and retired people who had invested in their own retirement. And it goes on. You know what it is. We have schools being shut down. We have all manner of support services being cut. We have the demand by students just trying to get a college education with such incredible amounts of stress and expense, which shouldn't be the case at all. Don't you think $124.3 billion could have done something to ease the burden on these various sectors that are so hard hit? But the same Congress that is now going to ponder and will likely deliver to Netanyahu $40 billion and more. That's just $40 billion, and there will be more for of other kinds of aid. And he's demanding it. 10 years. You have to commit to $4 billion of free money a year. Now you tell me who the real welfare people are. Here's a nation that has been a welfare state since World War II, at least, in terms of U.S., quote, donations and gifts of aid to this country. Total welfare. Completely free money. No obligation really placed on this particular state. And yet, all over the world, and particularly within the United States itself, the unwillingness to fund programs on the basis that we don't have the money, we don't have that kind of money to build schools and repair roads and bridges, we don't have the money to build hospitals and to staff them. We don't have the money to put in place a single-payer universal health care system. We don't have the money to do all these things. But this one state, and the summary, I'm not making this up. I'm reading directly from the official record that is provided to members of Congress by the Congressional Research Service. This is what they said. Israel is the largest cumulative recipient of U.S. foreign assistance since World War II. So now that we have this presidential race, and it's picking up speed, and everybody has to pledge their troth, as has been the case since World War II. Where do you stand on Israel? Everybody is made to account for where you stand on Israel. It's a kind of ritual. You can't possibly run for office. People are running for local office, dog catcher, in Podunk somewhere. Where do you stand on aid to Israel? That is the litmus test. And I raise this really to talk about when communities become serious about their interests and when they organize in service of their interests. This is the kind of power they wield because they fund their interests. They invest in their interests. They champion their interests. They take this so seriously that just about every single member of Congress, this they understand to be so important that they will set aside the interests of their own constituencies to put this first on their agenda. First on their agenda. There's no need. So powerful is this thing. There's no need to explain the efficacy of it. There's no need to explain what are we getting back for this $124 billion of free money that we decide to give from poor and working poor people who don't get any of this back in any form. You see, there's a relationship to handing out $124 billion of free money so you could buy more guns and more weapons and whatever dome system and whatever sling system you're devising to wipe out the Palestinians and all of your Middle Eastern neighbors, wipe out the Arabs, because the whole thing is, let's get the land. Because the land is everything first. Then we'll get everything, as I said, on it, in it, over it, under it, and around it. The fight is for the land. And this is how empires share an interest in genocide and in criminal acts. They build a rationale for it, and then they pump people's money into it. Now, nobody here in the United States at this time opposed to this has any way of affecting any of this in this democratic society. You will be asked to vote now, next year. They're already knocking at the door. Vote for me. But who is making this a litmus test as you may not continue this genocidal support? You will not do it. We will not countenance it. We will see to it. And we put your lights out. You're not going to be successful as an elected official anywhere if you support this. You don't have that kind of muscle. You don't even have that kind of guts. And by the way, lest anybody believe that this is just because, well, it's Israel, people hate Israel. The people of Israel themselves are saying this regime and this pattern has got to stop. Now, I'll share with you an article that I read over the weekend, written by Barbara Opal Rome. It's titled, American Military Aid to Israel Can't Be a Blank Check. Extraordinary. She says, Israel's foreign aid financing package, an outgrowth of the routinized grant aid put in place with the Camp David peace accord with Egypt, expires in 2017. Under the existing agreement signed by then President George W. Bush, foreign military financing to Israel grew from $2.4 billion to $3.1 billion in recent years. Under the follow-on package endorsed by Obama during his March 2013 visit, Israel is eyeing an annual top line of much more than $4 billion. And that does not include, she writes, more than $1.2 billion in war stocks pre-positioned here in Israel and available for Israel's use in times of emergency, and some $500 million in annual U.S. funding for cooperative anti-rocket and missile defense programs such as Iron Dome, Arrow, and David's Sling. She's writing from Tel Aviv. There's great opposition to this. And when we discussed this just last week in our Free Your Mind Friday session, Joel starting the conversation about this, we discussed that we do not hear in our media in the United States that, I should say, we do not hear outside, much outside of Israel, that there's a fierce opposition to this murderous regime. That Jews are offended, many, many Jews are offended by Israel's position in the world and the way it chooses to operate, the policies that it is enacting, the murderous, racist policies that it is enacting in the name of Zionism. But there's a very healthy opposition in Israel. We don't know that. We don't know that. But here in the United States, it is a foregone conclusion set in motion all the way back then that you get funding not just on an annual basis with automatic increases, but you, Israel, will get your money in 10-year commitments of billions of dollars, whatever you want. So here is this writer in Israel saying, it is not right that American military aid should be, he says, American military aid to Israel can't be a blank check. What is the subhead of this headline that she writes? She says, Netanyahu may be convinced Israel will forever live by the sword, but that doesn't mean that Washington must pay for it. So if anybody's under the impression that there's unanimity of agreement among Jews in Israel, that this is okay, that this whole business of militarization is okay, that they approve, and that Israel is of one mind on this, here's an example that says no. Fierce opposition to this. So I come back to this question of what are we supposed to understand about this visit, and what should it do to inform resistance and opposition to it, especially from the so-called progressive community? Well, Hillary Clinton certainly should explain when she was co-president of the United States with her husband Bill. What was the Clinton administration's response? How did it veer away from this formula of handing billions of dollars without question to a government that A, I have yet to see an audit as to how the money was spent, if they could account for every penny? And here's a guy, I mean, the man is the prime minister now, but we've discussed on this program that he, at one point, had been implicated as a smuggler of nuclear material out of the United States from a sham corporation in Florida to Israel, sending nuclear material against the law, so that technically, when he visited the United States on March the 3rd, he should first have been greeted by people serving him a warrant for his arrest. By law, he has violated serious, serious laws. Yeah? He has been trading and smuggling out of the United States nuclear material. That's been the charge. And here we are. In this democratic society, the point is that government is a criminal enterprise. There's great conspiracy. We are now in Congress. We are in the Senate. We are in the House. And we are untouchable. This is not government by the people for the people. The people haven't gotten any kind of say in why or if or how Israel should receive any kind of aid. And certainly this kind of aid, at this level of aid, $124.3 billion, free. When there are other places, you want to render aid, there certainly are other places that money could be spent. But there are people suffering right here in this country. But the country is aiding and abetting a murderous regime with your taxpayer dollars. And in this regard, the progressives agree with the conservatives, agree with the Republicans and the Democrats and the independents, people like Democratic Socialist / Independent candidate Bernie Sanders. They all are of the same mind. Israel gets what it wants. No matter what, no opposition. And even if we have to make Americans suffer and sacrifice needlessly because the money just isn't there to take care of really serious needs here by people who pay the taxes here and who should be enjoying the benefits of those taxes here, they will overlook that because that is secondary to, in their eyes, their political survival. So there we are. A fast lesson in political science and how politics works in this country. Because not even the president, who was so rudely treated by this marauder, Mr. Netanyahu, not even Barack Obama, as offended as he was by him, not even the president has the political will to simply say, nope, there's going to be a change. There are going to be some changes made around here. And I, as the president, I have the authority and the power to veto this. I have the authority and the power. Also, if Netanyahu could come to the United States and invade and hijack the democratic process in Congress, the president certainly could say, well, I am listening to the voice of the Israeli people, the people who object to Netanyahu and his murderous regime. I am listening to them. I'm paying attention to their concerns that they absolutely reject his administration. I'm going to listen to them because they're saying, Mr. President, do not give Israel, and we are Israelis, don't give us the money. Not under these conditions and not to do these kinds of things that Israel has been doing. They are appealing to the United States as Israelis. And they're saying, Mr. President, don't do it. But not even Obama, as offended as he is, as wronged as he is, has the power to say no. Isn't that interesting? In a great democracy, the people have spoken. Nobody's paying attention to them. Congress has a mind of its own on this question. It is doing whatever it wants to do. You and I, the people who are funding this through taxes and not yielding nearly one-tenth of the benefit of that investment in terms of the returns that we get. We're not seeing our young people basically being able to go to college and not having to worry about student debt. We're not seeing hospitals. We're not seeing the investment the government is making with taxpayer money in the people who are suffering here. But we're seeing that all sides agree, regardless of what they say their political philosophy is, they all agree that this is not going to be changed. This is the standing order, and their job, their number one job, is not to discuss the inordinate burden that this places on the United States. Their job is not to really find a way to say, well, wait a minute, we have to amend this. What is this automatic thing that every year the free money you get is going up and up and up? You are not accounting for a penny of it. You have terms of assistance that no other nation has anywhere that receives U.S. foreign aid. You could use some of your foreign aid for your social or domestic programs. The people of Israel, many of the people of Israel, reject this administration, reject this leader, so-called leader. But the United States says, we don't see it, we don't hear it, we don't know about it. How about that? American democracy. Yes. Well, that brings me to the end of the program today. It seems... in the end, I chose really good music called The Sermon because I feel like I just delivered one. But I want to thank you for allowing me to stretch out there. There were two other subjects that I didn't get to today, but they will be just as timely tomorrow, and I will get to them. But I want to thank you very much for your kind attention and for your support of this program and this station. Keep it right here. Coming up next is the Global Research News Hour. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. And until we see each other tomorrow, please note, from me, it is always a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. I thank you for listening today. Join me tomorrow and share this program with people that you know. I talked about the formation of Lead Stories study circles. You know, get a couple of people and share the program with them. Encourage them to go to the podcast at leadstories@podbean.com and on the PRN archives as well. And take a listen to some of our programs and share them with others. And let's help build a community where we begin to turn the attention to where it ought to be, which is, what are we thinking? What are we doing? What are we sharing with each other? How are we building community? Thanks again. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.